someone else wants to know, John wants to know whether this is a built amplifier built in to some kind of radio receiver or something, or is this just a separate amplifier?
Casey Capil. The model is a Metron MA1000B. It's a pallet amp that's for, it's strangely, it has mobile kind of mounting things on the side. It's not a bad amp. It's a dumb amp, though, because it does not have any voltage regulators pursuant to the other question. There are more sophisticated versions of this particular model and design that actually operate at 15 volts and actually have a 12-volt regulator. This one does not. It accepts whatever voltage you give it, and then it feeds it directly into the BIOS circuitry. So I'm assuming that there's going to be different constitutive behavior of the BIOS circuitry at 12.5 versus 13.8. The way I built, from the schematic that I built the amp at was for 13.8. I just noticed a different behavior when I hooked it up straight up to the battery, which kind of led to the question. Again, but maybe we have some interesting answers.
Okay, John, so did you hear that?
Yeah, QFL, and well, Paul hit the nail on the head, and I was going to go into that. And I don't have to tell the whole story, but basically, ham radio operators were yelling at me, oh, you can't run that 12-volt power supply in your radio. You'll never get full power out. Well, so I went and did the whole thing with a bunch of different radios I had in the shack, and the most I could come up with was only on high power on some radios. Maybe I had a 0.1 dB difference, and that probably had more to do with droop than with running 13.8 versus 12. But again, these are regulated radios that are meant to handle this range. I think he just answered his own question there with no regulation. Yeah, you're probably going to see a difference, and probably something substantial, I would imagine. Anyway, that's my comment, so I'll go back to listening here. Back to you, Roy. KC2, SHO.
WA2DH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I would think that with a normal design that the BIOS circuitry would be able to accommodate the usual variation that you get from battery operation, maybe handling as high as 14 volts or as low as 12.5. But I think you would get some variation in output power, but you would still be operating, the cue point of the transistor would still be in the linear range to allow it to function in a linear type of operation. I don't think you would end up driving a transistor into saturation or cutoff or anything like that at the limits of the operating voltage range. Oh, go ahead. Comment.
Okay, Brian, comment. Yeah, I mean, the problem is you require to kind of read the mind of the engineer who came up with the circuitry, how smart it is and how stupid it is. It sounds from Jeff's description that it ain't terribly bright. So although 9 cases out of 10, maybe people designed these things correctly, you can't kind of guarantee it just on the nature of humanity. Brian, what do you want to say?
Without voltage regulation, it will not be linear.
Well, if you happen to be on the linear part of the curve for whatever voltage you're using, unless it changes, well, also even if it changes, you just don't know where the linearity curve ends. So if you did, then you'd know the upper and lower range of that particular curve for that discrete amplification circuit.
If I run it at 13.8 or I run it at 12, there's going to be a difference.
Yeah, but if it's consistently running at that voltage, it doesn't necessarily, it can still be constant without it being regulated.
If the source is constant. force has to be constant in order for that to happen. That's why a unit with voltage regulation is far superior, because you have a steady flow, and without it, basically, and unregulated, you're going to have a variance.
VDH with a comment?
Yeah, John?
Well, without getting into any particular bias circuitry, if you look at, for example, how a bipolar transistor is biased, usually you will see some small resistance in the emitter circuit. That is basically there for a kind of bias stabilization. That, in other words, as the supply voltage would tend to increase, that would tend to limit, a drastic increase in the collector current. A small resistance, usually in the emitter circuit, is to provide a certain amount of bias stabilization and prevent things like the transistor going into saturation. That's why you'll usually see some small resistance in the emitter circuit to provide a bias stabilization.
Okay. AF2B with a comment.
Yes, please comment.
The rule of thumb.
Ed, are you out there? You started to answer the, make a comment, and then you fell off the repeater. I don't know, we seem to have said. Jeff, are you still there?
Roger.
Okay, very good. I don't know. I guess the consensus is generally that if it's reading a different voltage, it's problematic. What do you do with that? I don't know.
I built it to exactly to spec, based on the. At least one iteration of the schematics. I have a station monitor, several station monitors to check the linearity, and we'll do two-tone tests and all that as per FCC rules. And I'll let you know what I find out. But I was interested. There's a lot of people who are much smarter than me on this net, and I'm really, honestly, just genuinely curious as to how much current do you really need to have through an NPN power transistor to keep it in linear range? And yeah, that comes from the spec sheet, but people have different experiences and they might be able to share it. AC2PL, back to that.
Okay, very good. I look forward to you returning and telling us the results. I guess people with a lot of experience building and fixing these things have a much better sense. Most of us poor schnooks, we just read the specifications for the device that we bought.
Yeah, Roger. And actually, ironically, I ran across a friend of mine who was offering a Kenwood SM220, which is, as you know, the station monitor, which has to be a little oscilloscope, and in the handbook for it, it shows you how to make a trapezoidal output, which is where you feed in the RF input for the before the amplification, and then the some version of the amplified signal is the other direction, and you get a trapezoid, and it's supposed to be linear. And so I'm going to try that. I've never actually seen that. I usually just look at the flat topping of the audio QSL.
Yeah, I mean, that's a much simpler. I have an LP500 digital station monitor. It's a glorified LCD with a screen that does watt meters and viswas and all kinds of things. And one of the things that it does is if you hook up two couplers, you hook up one coupler to the driver and the other to the linear amplifier, you get a Zoid. So I generated it probably 10, 15 times before I got a little bit bored because it was always the same trapezoid. But it's a nice thing to see in action.
It's nice that it's boring, AC2PL. It's nice that it's boring because you're doing it properly, meaning that your station is running in the linear range and you're not splattering. That's actually awesome. I did not know the LP500. I've been looking at the LP100 forever, and I never actually bought one, but the LP500 must be really the Cadillac version. AC2PL, that satisfies my question, and I'll turn it back to Ned.
Okay, very good, Jeff. Yeah, the LP500, or if you need glasses, the LP700. I think a 7-centimeter diagonal, 7-inch diagonal screen instead of the LP500's 5-inch diagonal screen.
AF2P.
Say again?
AF2P.
Yes, what can I do you for?
I just want to apologize for, I fell out of the repeater. I don't know if you got my comment earlier, but it doesn't matter. The issue is settled. Back to Ned.
Yeah, Ed, I mentioned that you fell out of the repeater. You weren't even in kind of the second of your answer, and you just kind of disappeared. But, you know, I mean, we came to some conclusion. But I thank you very much for coming here and then helping out.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Rich, what do you got for us tonight?
Well, it's all about a perfectly working mag loop, and I decided to change the dimensions of it to make it bigger. So with the thought in mind of adding a couple of bands. Well, I did that, and I couldn't get the thing to work. And mag loops are very simple antennas, and I just couldn't get it to work. So out of total frustration, I redid the whole thing, and the way I make a mag loop is PVC pipe wrapped in copper foil. So I got all new copper foil, whole thing, the outer loop, rewrapped the inner loop, and still I was having trouble. So I changed the dimensions of the inner loop, and all of a sudden I have a working mag loop, but only on 30 and 40 meters. And the impedance is only like 36 ohms. So that's my first question. With an impedance of 36 ohms, what am I losing? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, did you run the VNA on it?
I ran two VNAs on it.
And what did this have? What did it say?
It said that the impedance was 36 ohms.
Okay, but I mean, theoretically, VNAs also can do viswas. If you have a 36 ohm load going, that needs to be 50 ohms, then the standing wave ratio is 50 divided by 36, which is 1.4. So you have a viswa of 1.4, most likely.
That's exactly right. but just on 30 and 40 meters, unfortunately. Don't know why that is, but I'm not going to rip this thing apart and do it for the third time. But here's another question. The copper foil of my original mag loop, with the mag loop being outside for about a year, turned from, you know, a bright copper color to a dark brown color. And since we're dealing with skin effect with these mag loops, I'm wondering if you think that the tarnished copper foil had anything to do with the lack of performance of the antenna.
I would tend to think not. Skin effect isn't a geometric concept. It's the surface, it's the conducting surface of a material. Not you know, if it has a insulating oxide layer, that's not where the current is. The current is, you know, depending upon the frequency, a couple of microns deep from the outer surface of the conductor. So it shouldn't. It might have an effect on your connectors to your capacitor, because if you don't scrape the tarnish off of it, it can lead to a significant resistance, and as I mentioned before, because of the high Q and the low radiation resistance, you know, a couple of ohms could kill a magnetic loop, and you know, using a tarnished contact to make an electrical connection is going to produce a lot more than 1 ohm of resistance.
And no, I made sure that I repaired the tarnish at the connecting points, both of the inner loop to the coax and the capacitor to the outer loop. So that wasn't the problem. But anyway, now I have a shiny new mag loop, and I'm wondering, is there anything that I could spray on it or paint on it to avoid it being tarnished like the last one, like polyurethane or something like that wouldn't affect the performance of the antenna?
I would imagine so. You know, get something that's made to paint over metals just to make sure that there won't be any weird side effects. It's your problem. It's the same way that people use wire antennas that are insulated, that have some kind of, non-conducting plastic or rubberized material. It might slightly detune it, but not sufficient to give you any problem. Because it goes back to Wes's comment about the dielectrics in the near field of a radiating antenna can slightly shift the resonance. But again, it shouldn't be a problem. Just obviously make sure on the end that it says it's designed to cover copper.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I wonder if that spray that you use on your car battery, you know, to prevent the connections from corroding, you know, that's a waterproof spray, and it serves that purpose, and I don't think it'll change anything. You might have to use a lot of it for a mag loop, but I think that would work. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it probably would work. I don't know if it's incredibly cost-effective. I would think that as long as you make sure that it's chemically neutral to copper, that it doesn't eat it away or anything strange, would probably suffice. I would assume that, you know, getting a generic spray can of paint would be significantly cheaper. I don't know how much this costs and how much quantity they give you. If it's only meant to be sprayed on battery terminals, it can come in a very small container. So you'd probably have to buy more than a few of them to cover the entire surface of a magnetic loop. But it certainly is doable.
can get the can. It's in my garage. I'll go get it. Anyway, back to you.
Okay. Yeah, like I said, Rich, you make sure that whatever the paint is, it's designed to cover up the copper. You should be good.
I don't know if I could find paint that would specifically say it's okay on copper, other than a clear coated thing, like I said, like polyurethane. You know, I'm wondering if regular paint would work, but I don't want to take a chance in, you know, doing something to make this MAC loop underperform. I'm getting about 1.4, 1.3 to 1.5 Vizoir, on 30 and 40 at different points of the band, but I think it would be pretty hard to find paint that says it's okay on copper.
N1Y, do you want to comment?
Yes, Hank.
There are a couple of different marine primers that are specifically designed for copper. You get them in West Marine.
Hank, what are they?
Marine primer paint. Available in West Marine.
I happen to have a West Marine very near where I live, so I'll check that out. And when they say it's okay with copper, what do they mean?
They mean the chemical base of the paint doesn't corrode the metal.
Okay. Well, Hank, you said there was a couple of them?
Well, I haven't looked in years, but when I used to have a boat, I know there were then.
Okay, I'll go to West Marine tomorrow and I'll ask them. Because before I put this antenna out in the wild, I would rather try to avoid it. Even though I agree with Roy, I don't think it makes that much difference if the copper tarnishes a little bit, but I sure couldn't get a second MAC loop with different dimensions to work with the tarnished copper. What I did with this copper tape, I just wrapped the outer and inner loop over the tarnished copper, and it's working now. So, I just don't want to, I guess, take the chance. So, I will go to West Marine. Thanks, Hank.
Okay, good luck. I'm glad you went clear.
Yes, Paul?
Okay, it sounds like Rich is going to go there. Anyway, this stuff is made by Lynx, L-Y-N-X. And, yeah, it's a battery terminal protection spray. Lead-free formula, fights battery corrosion, prolongs battery life, you know, all of that. So, and it's a big can. I mean, this is 10 ounces, and I don't think I paid that much for it. But, you know, you get it in AutoZone. But, yeah. But it sounds like Rich is going to try something else. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. Rich, I still think you should try to be a little experimental with the small driving loops that feed the actual magnetic loop, changing its dimensions, changing its location, whether it's in the plane of the magnetic loop or slightly in or slightly out, can have a significant effect on its resonance and its vizoir and its impedance value, how close it gets and such. Yeah, I think I suggested that a while back. So there's always a major variable that can have a significant effect on the operation of a magnetic loop.
did. I went from a smaller loop to a bigger loop. Remember, these loops are made of PVC, so they're rigid. They're rigid and can't be easily, you know, made bigger or smaller unless I cut PVC to different dimensions and then wrap it again. And what's amazing is I bought two rolls of copper tape, each 66 yards long, and I just had enough to, I can't give you the offhand the circumference of the outer loop, but it's amazing how much tape it took, and I was wrapping it on a slant, and it still took an amazing amount of tape to wrap this loop in its entirety. So I'm going to use it right now on 30 and 40, see how I do, and take it from there. I'm certainly mag-looped out at this point because it took a lot of effort to redo this loop and get it working on 30 and 40.
Easy to deal.
Yes, Jeff?
Question, is there any adhesive on the tape?
There is on one side.
I think that presents a problem.
Well, again, think about wrapping PVC. Isn't the skin effect come into play with the outer surface of the tape rather than the underneath side of the tape?
Well, yeah, the problem is that the adhesive might be somewhat resistive, and so that's going to add more insertion losses again. You know, with a normal magnetic loop, the conductivity is not going around the surface of the actual tape. It's both going horizontal and vertical, and, you know, 360 degrees. The whole thing is a solid conductor, whereas strips of a copper that are backed in dubious adhesives means that the current is not just kind of flowing straight through, but going hither and thither.
Yeah, well, that's, I've thought of that. I wondered if the adhesive, and it's a very, very thin layer of adhesive, but because the backing of the tape comes off so easily, I can't imagine they used a lot of adhesive, just enough for it to stick to itself or another surface. But I thought that, you know, I worried about that. But my first loop, done the same way, I worked the world with it. I really had a great time with it. So I don't think the adhesive downgraded the efficiency of the loop that much. I know it didn't, because if I could hear them, I could work them type of thing. So we'll see how this new loop does. The inner loop is bigger, and I don't know why I just got two bands out of it rather than, let's say, you know, 17 and 10 or 20, 30 and 40. But it won't go down to 20. Don't know why. But I'll use it, and if not, I have my beloved NFED half wave. Back to net.
Okay. Yes, Jeff?
Every mag loop that I built, I had my own little mag loop phase. I would measure the inductance of the loop, the capacitance at each end of the capacitor, and I put the whole thing together, and I would see where it would tune up, or where it was resonant, or where it would dip, whatever the du jour measurement is. Fine. It has to do with the electrical properties of the inductance of the loop and the capacitance of the capacitor. That those are the only things that play a role in where it's resonant and where it plays. The resistance has to do with the efficiency. So if you are using a material which actually is wrapped in, you know, maybe the temperature was lower, the temperature was higher, the humidity was lower, the humidity was higher, the thing got wet somehow. And the point is that if you have an absolute conductor around the outside, and you measure the inductance of that loop, and you have a capacitor, and you measure the lowest capacitance and the highest capacitance, then you know exactly how this thing's going to play. It's actually very, very easy to calculate roughly where the thing's going to play. Back to that.
Yeah, okay. Very good advice. Look, it's not going to be optimal. You know, if you get it done by the Jet Propulsion Lab and they basically just vacuum deposited silver all over a hoop or what have you, it probably would be a more efficient design, and it probably would have cost you, you know, $20,000. So if it works, great. Please come back, tell us how it's working for you, and you know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, the way I tested the loop was with a nano VNA and also a Rig Experts VNA. And I just turned the capacitor and watched where the dip moved. And I was surprised that when it started headed up to the 20-meter band, it stopped and came back. So I didn't get 20 meters out of it, which did surprise me. But we'll see how it goes. I'll see how it performs on 30 and 40. And if it performs well, I'll just leave it at that. And I know it's not going up to 80 because it doesn't have the size, or down to 80. It doesn't have the size to do that. But I'm a little surprised about 20. We'll see what happens. Back to that.
One more quick comment.
Sure.
AC Capil, if you have the ability to measure milliohms, you actually need a four-wire device. And I have a kind of primitive one in the, what do you call it, the DERVE, whatever, the 2000 that everyone uses. It's the entry-level four-wire device. You can actually measure milliohms and see what the resistance is of each component in the loop. And that might actually tell you if that adhesive of the tape is actually resistive or if it's not resistive. Give us a
KF2CC.
Yes, Brian?
I'm just listening, and actually I'm getting a little bit tired, so I'm going to go QRT, and I wish everyone a good evening, and hopefully I'll have more energy next week. So take care, everyone. 73.
Okay, 73, Brian. We'll talk to you down the line.
What I'm concerned about more than the adhesive is the connections from the capacitor to the loop. They're a little longer than I would like them, but the way I built this loop, they have to be at least 4 inches. So I'm a little worried about that.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you know, you don't really have the equipment to figure out the efficiency. You're just going to use it and see if it's, you know, compare it to your previous mag loop, and if it's close to that, then you'll be happy with it.
Yep. Again, I just, you know, they say keep those leads as short as possible. And sometimes you make a loop where the loop actually goes right into the capacitor, attaches directly to the capacitor. Here I needed to use ground straps to connect the capacitor to the loop. And I sure would like it to go directly, connect directly to the loop, but to the capacitor. but can't get that done with this design anyway. All right, I think, thanks everybody. I think I will go to West Marine and then test this antenna out.
Well, good luck, Rich, and I'm sure you'll get hours and hours of enjoyment. And I look forward to the fish stories of the fish that you caught in that magnetic loop. So go forth and transmit. Anyway, this is T2TS and Limark Technical Met. We still have a significant amount of time tonight if anyone wants to avail themselves of it. If you have any questions or comments or topics for discussion, hit that push to talk and put yourself on the list. It sounds like there's no one with any questions or comments or topics for discussion tonight. We could go straight to Space Report if that's your inclination. I'll give you guys one more chance to ask a question or make a comment or bring up a subject. So if you're out there and you got something on your mind, hit that push to talk.
Easy to peel. What happened at Levittown today?
I don't know. I talked to some people who attended, and they had a great time. If anyone out there went to the Ham Fest today and would like to report on it, please feel free. Hit that push to talk. I guess all of us played hooky. Again, I talked to one person on my 10-meter net this afternoon. He had just returned from it, and he had a great time.
N1YDY.
So driving out to East Quag, and I drove by with much shame. I could not stop. I had, two German Shepherds in the car, and I had to keep going and get to what I had to do out there. But I will definitely make my most honest attempt next time. I do remember very fondly going there and watching Andy operate the IFR equipment and testing people's stuff.
A couple of Hamfests, I actually had a table right next to him on the stage, and I could watch him do his magic. I miss him. Anyway, Hank, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just was going to ask you the frequency and time of your 10-meter net.
Oh, okay. The standard frequency that we give people is 28.380. I often have a noise spur on 80, so I usually move over to 28.381.
All right, 381, and what days do you run it?
It's Sunday morning from 11 o'clock to approximately 1 o'clock. If things kind of slow down, sometimes I bail out at 12:30 or 12:45. Starts at 1. It starts at 11, rather.
All right, thanks. I'll try to get a 10-meter antenna up for next week.
Ah, great. I that would be wonderful. Sometimes it gets lonely there.
Thanks. And one way do I?
Okay. This is still the Limark Technical Net. We're still open for business. So it's up to guys out there. If you got a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, feel free. Hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
what's the best antenna to use for the net? I used to have a wire that on 10 meters worked great, and the vertical worked terrible. Not really sure why. Both of them were, you know, kind of obscured by buildings, but both should have been okay. One wasn't, one was.
Okay, I mean, ultimately, it sort of depends on all kind of variables of your location, your elevation, what have you. Presently, I'm very happy. I have a stereo 5/8 wave vertical, has a nice takeoff angle, and it works rather well. I used to use a fan dipole, and I would actually combine the two into a diversity reception with one of the antennas going to my left ear and the other going into my right. So I really like the stereo. It's nice and sturdy. It's been up there longer than any other antenna I've owned.
Roger. What, I'm querying the other station who just came in about 10 meters. What antenna are you planning to put up, and what performance do you expect? And what kind of, kind of small antenna sort of requirements do you have? A lot of us have very limited property to put antennas up.
Hank, do you hear Jeff? I guess Hank left.
Well, I just got too far from the button. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Did you hear Jeff's question? He was asking what kind of antenna are you thinking of putting up in your... in your shack?
Well, I've got a couple of 108-inch CB antennas that I was going to make a dipole out of.
Yeah, that should work.
So I've got those. I've got the piece of aluminum angle bracket that I can use to mount one and insulate the other. Actually put an SO239 on the other and put one directly onto the bracket. And I'll try to make it vertical only because it's easier to stick it out on the balcony. And if that doesn't work, then...
Hank, your signal deteriorated and then you fell out of the repeater, but we got most of the answer.
That's interesting. I wonder if I'm having a power supply problem. Anyone more anyway?
Okay, well, these things have been known to happen more than a few times. I've been talking to people on the net and their power supply just kind of failed them. So, fortunately, it's very... Anyway, once again, this continues to be AC2GS. It continues to be the Limark Technical Net. And, it's up to you guys. We've got a half hour to kick around if you're so inclined. More than willing to entertain any question or comment or topic, but I don't want to do a soliloquy, lots of it. So if you're out there and you got a question or a comment or a topic, sometimes one little question can roll around for an hour on our tech net. It's amazing how that happens. But if you're out there and you got something, please hit that push to talk.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, John.
Yeah, Roy, I'm not on the air. You know, I've been on for, like all of us, taking a hiatus right now. We're doing construction. We've got a state And during that time is when all of these FCC regulations came out with needing to measure the radiation on your station. If you're familiar with that, what is involved with that? I'm really totally ignorant to it. I've heard that it has to be done. What are the requirements with that now?
Okay, I mean, the FCC introduced it in a rather loosey-goosey way that, you know, they mentioned it for about 5 minutes, and then I haven't heard them mention it ever since. The story goes that you have to be able to know the dangers of your setup. There are equations and web pages. I set up one for my other club, the Kings County Radio Club. A gentleman checked into this technical net and offered a web page script that did it. The ARRL itself has a similar page, so probably the easiest thing is to Google ARRL, you know, radiation measurements or, you know, such regulations. You get a page. It asks you for the gain of your antenna, the output power that you're feeding into the antenna, its elevation, distance away from people in your home, distance away from people who pass by your home, and you generate a piece of paper that gives all those numbers, and you keep it in your shack, and you have done what the FCC requires you to do. Will the FCC ever come and ask you for that piece of paper? I'm not a betting man, but I would bet the house that you'll never get a request. But that's what the rules are.
Yeah, okay. It, you know, it sounds reasonable. I think it's more of a start of something, you know, but it sounds reasonable. Okay, interesting. And thank you. It sounds simple enough to do that. Number two, Zulu Charlie, back to that.
You're welcome, John. Yeah, I don't think they wanted to make it difficult. I think they started by scaring everyone at the very, very beginning, but then it settled into one of those things where you can, you know, go to a web page, you fill out the form, you print out the piece of paper, you put the piece of paper in your filing cabinet. So it's real low impact. You know, they could have made it much more painful. They could have required someone with a license to make these measurements come to your house and charge you a ridiculous sum of money. I think if they did that, they knew that there would be very few people who would follow that rule. And there's no specific guidelines of what date it must be done. It just says you must do it, and it kind of leaves it open. So, yeah, it shouldn't be a major pain in the backside. As long as you know what kind of antenna you have and, you know, what kind of gain it has, it's rather a simple thing.
Right. And since it's slow, since we all missed, with the seven of you, of course, missed the net some night, ever any mention ever again about this? I know there was a lot of concern about auctioning off part of the ham bands. Any mention, or is that just with, you know, hopefully a one-minute wonder?
Yeah, it pretty much was a one-minute wonder. The organization put it in a preliminary request for evaluation, but I think when they heard the people were reacting poorly, they reissued the request and removed that portion of it. So that went the way of all things. But like most news, the bad stuff gets published and republished and republished, and the relatively good news just kind of sits there, and you know, it's not, it doesn't cause people to click on YouTube, so they don't do an article on that, unfortunately. But it's a done deal. It's dead. It's a, you know, for the most part, the only thing to frighten us is that announcement from the FCC, you know, of deregulating everything and looking for recommendations from the public. They haven't gone anything past that point. So I'm willing to bet that we probably won't hear back from the FCC about this. for the next 3+ years. It's just something that they did for the sake of doing it. I don't think they want to be bothered reading the suggestions even. I think if we kind of disappeared one night, they wouldn't look where we went. You know, the FCC, I think, is a little bit too highfalutin for us poor hens. You know, they're into telecommunicating companies and multi-billion-dollar industries and such, and we're kind of the poor guy.
Yeah, that might be a good thing. All right, good, good. That's good news. You know, when that came on the radar, that's one of those things in life where, you know, you got all other things going on, and this going wrong, and, like, you really don't pay things. I mean, you know, you got to be kidding me. You know, those long-time staples in life, you may get challenged, but that's all part of the ride here. Nobody else is going to jump in. I'll continue to keep the neck going, Bob, but if anyone else wants to jump in, just please do. What are your feelings, Roy, with the ARRL? I know there's a lot of, well, I'm not going to say a lot. There is some people out there, but the former ARRL employees, I won't name any of them, but I think we all know who they are, expressing a lot of dissatisfaction with the salaries and the fact that they express that the ARRL just really isn't advocating strongly enough or accomplished enough or, you know, whatever. They're not really that versed in the grievances and stuff. Any feelings on your end, as far as the organization? Are you satisfied with it? Are they doing what they should be doing? I myself have never for these big CEO salary type, arrangements. I don't ever think anybody's worked that much, but that's the only pet peeve I could see with them. I really don't follow it close enough to render an opinion on their effectiveness or not.
Yeah, I mean, ARRL behavior in the last 10 years has had some problematic aspects to it. They are tending to reshape the organization to be significantly more opaque than it once was. They've passed laws that the elected officers can't disagree with the board in public, which doesn't really sound like your basic American free speech attitude. So I'm a little concerned about that. I was moderately upset with how they handled the massive increase in dues and the magazine subscriptions and the fact that it changed over independent of whether you had paid ahead of time or not. You know, usually with organizations, you pay a year or you pay for 3 years, and that's that. They don't usually come back and say, well, we made the price higher, and we're going to enact it in 2 days. Have a nice day. So I don't know. They're treating it like a business. I think they're looking for profits. Organizations like this aren't supposed to be profitable. That's why it's called a nonprofit organization. But, you know, I don't know exactly if they're taking that part seriously. And I think that should concern us all. It's supposed to be an organization that represents us. It's not a business where they interact with hams. That's a different organization entirely. So I'm a little bit suspicious of recent moves. I hope it isn't a trend that gets worse, because it can get worse, a lot worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Did I understand you right? Was the situation that if you subscribe for like 2 or 3 years and you pay, did they come back and want more money from you? Did I understand that right, or is that not the case?
Yeah, that's the case. I don't think it was for membership. What happened was originally, as you know, with the membership, they threw in the subscription. So they decided that they didn't want to do that anymore. So the subscription, the dues paid just for you being a member of the club. You could read the magazine on your computer. It was available on their website, but they wouldn't send you a printed copy unless you paid an additional sum of money. And even though you paid your dues for that year with the understanding that you got the magazine, if you didn't pay extra for the magazine come January 1st, they would stop mailing you the magazine, which I think is a cheapskate type of thing to do.
Yes, I agree with you. You know, it used to be customary to phrase the grandfather people in, you know, in all aspects of life and society. But from this point on, and there was a certain amount of fairness to that. Like many corporations will decide to terminate a pension plan, and then all of a sudden, well, the guy's been here 28 years, but not just doing it for new employees, doing it for, everybody, that type of thing. So, yeah, I agree with you. That would leave a bad taste in my mouth, and I can't say I disagree with them with that, charging two different prices, maybe they're just trying to control things. I know myself, when I was working, I'm retired now, I didn't have time to read the magazine. I feel guilty. I throw it on the side, never read them, and eventually throw them out.
Yeah, they had a big problem at one point finding supplies for paper. This was in the middle of COVID. And, if you remember your magazine subscription, there was a month or two where it looked like they were printing this stuff on toilet paper. It was so thin. Yeah, Hank, what?
What club was this? What organization?
The American Radio Relay League.
I guess since I'm not a member, I didn't recognize it.
They had problems getting paper for a while, so I guess they just were sick and tired and...
program, or do you get your magazine with your membership now?
No, that's a thing of the past. If you want to get the printed magazine, you have to pay extra. You can download it, you could read it. I don't even know if you can download it, really. You can copy pages, but you could read it on their website. They have an application for iPads. And you get on the web and such, so you can read QST and QEX and the other one that's for contesters, but if you want a printed copy mailed to you, you got to pay through the nose. The magazine's pretty decent these days. For a while, it was sort of non-technical. There's a lot of information on, laundry lists of guys who got points in contests that, I didn't exactly know what the point of that was myself, but who knows. But it's gotten significantly more technical over the last 7 or 8 years. They made an active move to do that. I still think the Radio Society of Great Britain has a magazine called Radcom, which is even more technically sophisticated. It's a very good magazine to read if you're into magazines. They're very few and far between these days. Most of them have unfortunately gone out of business.
I used to enjoy having magazines when I was working. It was a nice way to be able to pass a little bit of time when you weren't busy, without having to try to log into something online. But thanks again for telling me what was going on. Yeah, the last time I was an ARRL member and read QST was immediately prior to COVID because I wasn't finding it as technically interesting as it had been maybe a decade or so before that.